When the history of Australian sport is discussed, there are several names that prompt almost immediate recognition, not only from sports fans, but from the community in general. Sir Donald Bradman is perhaps the most recognisable of them all, but there is a name in the sport of golf that conjures up similar images and memories, and in many ways contributes to that sport as much as Bradman himself did to the sport of cricket. Some may suggest even more. Norman von Nieder is in so many respects the quintessential Australian sportsman. From humble beginnings, the Von, as he is affectionately known, is very much a self-made man, who achieved international success at a time when it was certainly not easy to do so. Essentially, he trailblazed for those who were to follow, and that he has strong convictions and opinions, and is certainly not afraid to voice them, is perhaps a reflection on the fact that he did so much of the hard work himself. Importantly, however, in the context of what we're about to discuss, the Von has shown a willingness to give back to the game, and indeed society, much of that which it has given him. It would be certainly difficult to find a kinder, more giving man. I say Norman von Nieder, but I can hear many saying, shouldn't it be von Nieder? Well, let's just hear what the great man himself has to say on that very subject.
Well, it's not so much the pronunciation of the word, Nieder or Nieder, but the European pronunciation is Nieder, and because the name is a German name, that's what I'm usually called over in Europe. But to me, it never really bothers me one way or the other whether it's Nieder or Nieder.
Born in Sydney in 1914, Norman's family moved to Brisbane soon after, and eventually took up residence in the eastern suburb of Pinkenba. This was to prove significant, as the two great passions in Norman's life, golf and horse racing, were close by. In fact, the Von Nieder home was actually within walking distance of both the Eagle Farm Racecourse and the Royal Queensland Golf Club. And from a very early age, Norman's life revolved around both.
With regards to my involvement in golf, it was through being a caddy, and my involvement in the thoroughbred was because my home was opposite the training establishment of a man by the name of Naud. And in 1928, he had a horse by the name of High Sice that went on to win the Caulfield Cup. And I used to ride walking exercise horses from the stable up and down Stevenson Street.
Norman's first exposure to the game of golf came while earning pocket money caddying at Royal Queensland. That resulted in a passion for the game that saw him win many of the caddy events around that time. In 1929, at the age of 15, and as the leading caddy at Royal Queensland, he was chosen to caddy for Walter Hagen, the greatest player of that era and one of the greatest of all time. In fact, only Jack Nicklaus has won more professional majors. On that day, Norman saw firsthand just what could be achieved with the talent and passion for the game he himself possessed. He admired Hagen both as a man and a golfer. It was an eye-opening day.
Well, the rapport and the connection that he had with the galleries was just so amazing, and also the way that he dressed and the way he conducted the balance between playing the game and allowing the galleries to appreciate how skillful he was. That influenced me tremendously.
Soon after that experience, and in an era where employment was difficult to come by, Norman, by virtue of his golfing connections, managed to secure a job at the local meatworks.
I got a job at the meatworks at the abattoirs, which is across the river from the golf course I used to caddy at. And the reason that I went there was that it was necessary for me to earn money, because it was in the Depression time, and the fact that through caddy, the superintendent of the meatworks, Mr. Sunners, suggested that you get a job at the meatworks working as a labourer, and what we call a boy labourer, because they have certain sort of ages and specific types of jobs that they can sort of earn quite a bit of money. And my father, he was the fitter and turner at the meatworks, and we were both working together there, so it was quite a good income for me, because working on the floor, that's where the killing floor, I was able to earn more money than my father was as a veteran turner at the meatworks. And that was a big asset and a big help to the sort of income for the whole family, because we were a family of seven boys and two girls. And in the Depression days, it was very difficult to get a job. And it was the fact that I was sort of riding a bike to work, I became reasonably fit. And from getting fit through riding the bike for a bit of recreation, riding in races. And but on a training run that I met Mr. Mullins, who was the captain of Nudgee Golf Club, and I watched him hit a few balls off the first tee one day, and I was sitting on my handlebars, and he looked up. He must have sensed that somebody was looking at him, and he said to me, "Not bad, eh, son?" And my answer to him was that fair, and it must have been the inflection in my voice that he probably took umbrage to it, but he said, "Well, do you think you could do any better?" And my answer to him was that I wouldn't play if I couldn't do any better than that, sir. And he said, "Well, show me." And I took off my cycle shoes and my bare feet. I hit about 10 balls down the fairway. And he said, "Where did you learn to play, son?" I said, "I was a caddy at Royal Queensland, and I became the caddy champion." And he said to me then, he said, "Would you like to become a member here?" I said, "I'd like to, but unfortunately I don't have enough money." He said, because the money that I earn at the meatworks, I said, comes into the household to sort of sustain the whole family with regards to that. And my father's salary is, we get along pretty fine. And he said, "Well, I'll pay for your sort of membership fee." And then I answered, I said, "Well, I couldn't afford the clubs either." And he said, "Well, don't worry about that. I'll give you a new set of clubs." And from then on, we became firm friends, and unfortunately for him, about 2 months later, I played him in the final of the club championship, and I was fortunate enough to win the club championship, beating him in the final. And when we were having a lemonade up in the clubhouse, he said to me, "Why don't you play in the Queensland Open, which is on in about 3 weeks, and the Queensland Amateur, which is the week after, that's qualifying round. The Open is the qualifying rounds for the amateurs in the amateur championship." I said, "I couldn't afford to sort of stay away from work for that long." "Don't worry about that," he said. "I'll pay for the whole 2 weeks that you're off," and he said, "a bonus as well." And that's how I played in the Open. I think I finished, I think, fourth in the Open, and I was fortunate enough to beat Dr. Clive Boyce in the final of the amateur championship, and it's then that I turned pro.
In 1935, Gene Sarazen, another of the game's greats, came to Australia for the second time, and in beating him in a challenge match at Royal Queensland, Norman reinforced his golfing ambition and gained much of the self-belief that would lead to such a successful career.
The fact that I was fortunate to beat Mr. Sarazen at the time, and the words that he spoke to me when I asked him, would it be possible for me to become a player such as he, travelling around the world, it was that he said, "Little man, who did you beat today?" And I said, "You." He said, "Well, you displayed skills today that at my age and your age," he said, "you played the shots better, or you had more skill relative to the shots that you had to play today, demonstrated to me that you weren't overawed by playing the number one player in the world. But I'd give you one piece of advice, and that is, instead of practicing on the practice tee like people do today," he said, "you've already developed the skill, and the skill shots that you've played today indicate that you have the skill, but to reinforce that, you must go out onto the golf course and experiment with clubs to play certain types of shots, so that at any given time when you have to play a shot that is a difficult type of shot, you've already practiced it, and there's never any self-doubt about your ability to play that shot." And he said, "That will enhance your scoring capability," and that's how I become the player that I became around the world.
And so the stage was set for Norman von Nieder to take on the golfing world. A move to Sydney resulted soon after, and after winning just about everything going in New South Wales at that time, the urge to tackle the world got the better of him. Norman's first overseas venture was to the Philippines in 1938 for the Philippines Islands Open, with an attractive first prize of some $2,000, which I imagine would have been a small fortune in those days. It was very enticing, but it was going to require a long boat trip from Sydney just to get there. Here's Norman again.
In 1938, I read that the Philippine Open was being played at Manila, and the first prize was, roughly $5,000. I'm not sure of the exact amount, but it was much more than what I could play for here in a year. So I was working for a sporting goods company by the name of Slazenges, and I got them to advance me the money to go up there and play, and took roughly around about 2.5 weeks from Sydney to Manila on the boat. Fortunately for not for me, I won, and I repeated the exercise the following year, 1939, and that was the beginning of my career travelling around the world.
Well, as he suggested, the Von won that event and returned the following year to win again. Broader horizons were looming, however, and in 1939 he left for the US, fulfilling an ambition to play there for the first time that year. The end result was not a financially successful trip, but it certainly played a role in moulding the Von Nieder game, and was to prove invaluable experience for his return to international golf after the war.
Well, the visit to America that happened in 1939 was that I was fortunate enough to play in the US Open at a golf course by the name of Spring Mill in Philadelphia, and it was at the tournament that Byron Nelson won his first US Open. And from playing with players like he and Sam Snead and Ben Hogan and all of those really great players, Ralph Woodard, played the last two rounds with Ralph Woodard, who'd won the previous two Opens in 1938, or 37 and 38. He was the US Open champion. And the exposure of playing with those really great players was a marvellous sort of asset to me with regards to my future game.
In 1946, the Von set his sights on playing the British Open at St Andrews that year, and left for the UK by ship, arriving there with just £17 in his pocket.
Well, in 1946, I set off for Great Britain, and the Stirling Castle was the ship which was taking back the soldiers and sailors of Great Britain that were out here in administrative sort of capacity, and they were on the boat, and I was the only sort of passenger on the boat. It took 5 weeks, and when I landed in Southampton in England, I think I had only £17, and I knew that I had to sort of play well, otherwise it was difficult for me because I never had a return ticket. But I was fortunate in that I played a practice round at Wentworth with the local pro, Archie Compston, and I was fortunate. It was what they call the short course at Wentworth, and I'd shot a 62 in this practice round with Mr. Compston, and he suggested that as I could play well, could I play for money? And I explained to him that after the war I used to play against the bookies to sort of get the money for me to travel to Great Britain, and that I was used to playing for money. But I said, I don't have any money. He said, well, don't worry about that. He said, I'll put up the money and we'll play. There's two amateurs that have been robbing me for quite some time, and he said, we'll play them, and whatever we win, you get half. And fortunately for me, Mr. Compston won £1,500. That's what we won playing against these two amateurs, and I had £750 before I started, so that was made a lot of continued playing.
Norman's exploits as a golfer have been well documented. He went on to leave an indelible mark on European golf, where he was the winner of many regular tour events during the 40s and 50s. He was placed fourth in the British Open behind Sam Snead in 1946 at St Andrews, and third behind Henry Cotton at Muirfield in 1948. He won the Australian Open on three occasions, was four times the Australian PGA champion, and won countless state and other titles in his homeland. He certainly left his mark on the course, but it is his generosity and preparedness to help those around him that will perhaps be the Von's greatest legacy. On arriving in Britain, Norman, like so many Australians who had gone before, and indeed have done so since, had the Brits wondering just what made Aussies tick. Dave Thomas, one of the stars of British golf in the 50s and 60s, had this to say about his very first impressions of Norman.
You know, going back to when I first met Norman, which, well, without actually meeting him, was watching him play golf in the late 40s, and early 50s, you know, when he was playing on the tour here. And he was somebody that you stayed away from, you know, you basically bit your bloody head off. But as I began, you know, to play better, and I played with him and alongside him, and then he sort of, in a sense, took me under his wing, I saw the other side of the man.
And then he describes why Norman did take him under his wing.
You see, I lost my father when I was 15, and so really didn't have that person to lean on, you know, that everyone needs. You know, it's always been up to me. Norman was someone that I felt you could lean on. Not for money, although if you wanted money, you could have all of it if that was what you wanted. But it wasn't a question of that. It was wanting support, moral support, let's say. Support that what you were doing was the right thing, and vice versa. If it wasn't, you know, because he would tell you. You know, he was obviously, as you know, very straightforward, and didn't pull any punches, and as such, you had confidence in the man. And this was where, you know, when I nearly won or finished tied with Peter Thompson in 1958, you know, the only person who thought I could win the Open Championship was Norman. And he said, and if I could caddy for you, which they weren't allowed, another pro, he said, if I could caddy for you, we'd win by a street. And of course, you know, I finished tied. But, you know, I never thought that I would get that far. But he saw something that other people didn't, or certainly I didn't. And I think that was his biggest problem with me. I was the typical doubting Thomas. I didn't and wouldn't accept how good I was. That he was trying to do most of the time, that self-belief to make me come out of the shell a little bit. You know, I wasn't exactly totally shy, but I wasn't someone who put myself forward. And of course, that's like an anathema to Norman. You're better than any of those bastards. That, you know, he's one of those unforgettable men, unforgettable characters, which he is a character. That are, you know, very few and far between. And you know, I feel very, as I say, privileged that he should remember, you know, of all the people I can think of that he's helped over the years, and all the good players, the Devlins, the Cramptons, the Thompsons, they all had something to thank Norman for.
Another who Norman played a significant role in assisting to achieve greatness was the highly successful Australian jockey, Scobie Breasley. I asked Scobie just how and where he got to know Norman.
Norman was always interested in horse racing. He used to go to racing quite a lot, and naturally I got to know him. And then I used to play a lot of golf as well. And when he would come to Melbourne, he'd naturally contact me, and we would get together, and if he wasn't playing competition, he'd be practicing, and we would play, you know, a couple of rounds of golf together.
Well, in England, just a few years later, Breasley had a serious race fall, fracturing his skull and incurring other debilitating injuries that left him virtually unable to walk. Norman came to the rescue. Scobie takes up the story.
Yes, I had a bad fall at Alexander Park back in 1954. And I had a fractured skull, and I damaged my balance nerve, and I couldn't get around. I wasn't in hospital that long, but I'd been there for a while, and when I came out, I couldn't get around very well without the help of my wife and our daughter, Loretta. But as it happened, Norman was in England at the time, and there was no competition for a while, and we got in contact, and the doctor told me, the specialist said, if I could get out walking, doing walking, it would help my balance. So I asked Norman, would he come out and take me up to Sunningdale, where I was a member, and we just walk around, not play around, but walk around hitting golf balls. And he used to come up each day and done that for quite a while until he had to go and play golf. And it improved me greatly, and I much appreciated what Norman done for me. And as I say, it improved me. The doctors had told my wife and the people I was retained by, that they didn't think I would ever ride again. They didn't tell me, but as I say, they told my wife and the people who retained me. They engaged another jockey for the Joe Mercer for the rest of the season. And anyhow, with the help from Norman, I rode within 3 months and started off at a place called Goodwood. And I had a couple of winners, and it got me going again and helped my confidence. And everything went very well.
On his recovery, Breasley went on to ride the winners of the Arc de Triomphe and twice the English Derby, winning more than 3,000 races worldwide during his career. Yet another great Australian sportsman to gain from von Neider's experience and advice was golfer Peter Thompson, who became the beneficiary of much of the trailblazing that Norman had done in the UK. I asked Peter where he first met Norman and how the influence of the von had impacted on the great career he himself went on to have.
Well, friends of mine introduced me to him when I was about 18, 19. He was a big figure in the game here in Australia. He came to Melbourne frequently, actually, to play golf. Socially, I think you'd term it socially, apart from a tournament once a year, perhaps. But anyway, soon enough, he really encouraged me to follow his own lead and tried in the professional game, which seemed to me a pretty romantic kind of a life. If one could roam the world and dress in all those beautiful clothes that he used to wear. So an impressionable youth like me fell for it. And he was really the pathfinder for all of we Australians that eventually went to play golf overseas. He had done it actually prior to the war. He'd gone to the Philippines twice before the Second World War. But then he, after the war finished, he continued that kind of roaming, and he went to England in the first Hastings bombers that were used to transport us to Britain. And as I say, that seemed a very romantic thing for a young man like me to see Buckingham Palace and all the sights of London. So I was right in it without any second thoughts. Well, he was an extraordinary generous man who seemed to go out of his way to be kind to people like me, who were not his own generation. I was a lot younger than him, and I was really bowled over by his generosity.
In 1956, another young golfing star was arriving on the world scene just a few years after Thompson, namely the South African Gary Player. Norman was quick to recognise the talent of the then 20-year-old, and Player outlines here just how and where he met Norman and the important role the von played in shaping a career that would go on to become one of the best in professional golf.
Well, I first met Norman in 1956, and that was at the Sunningdale Golf Club, and I just won the tournament with a world record. And he came up to me and he just said, "Son," he says, "you've really got it." He says, "you're going to be a world champ." And at that stage of my career, that was such an encouraging thing. And he said, "How would you like to visit Australia?" I said, "I'd love to." And that was the start of my wonderful trek to Australia, where I won 7 Australian Opens, and which is a record, and still the lowest score in the Australian Open, 264. And it's it's remarkable that a record should last that long with all the modern illegal equipment. I don't know how it's done it, but it has. And thanks to Norman von Neider, he not only invited me there, but he got me an air ticket, a return air ticket to South Africa, and he got me a little bit of appearance money, and I played some exhibitions at £25 a game, traveling throughout the country for Schlesingers at that time. And so really, he was a wonderful golfer, and he was a good teacher. And he always helped people. He was always giving, and everybody talks about leaving the world a better place. The only way you can do that is by giving something to the world. And this is indicative of what Norman Vinita did. He was always giving and helping people, giving them bits of money, arranging this, arranging that, letting you stay at his house. I mean, he was just unbelievable. And he was a bit of a feisty golfer, but that's quite an advantage. He was cocky and had confidence in himself and played very, very well wherever he went. But I think the big thing is that he was a giver. And I mean, he helped Frank Phillips, he helped Bruce Crampton, he helped just everybody that I could think of. And I know when I went over there, he just every day he came along and said, anything I can do for you. We used to play bunker shots together at £1 a shot because we both thought we were the best bunker player around. And he just helped to make everybody happy. And if you can do something like that and be proud of your country, what a proud Australian he is. Wherever he went, he was so proud of Aussie. And now I just love Norman Vinita, and he had a great wife in Elva. That's a very big thing for a pro, to have a good wife. So I cannot speak highly enough of this man.
Bruce Crampton, the fine Australian golfer who in many ways did for Australian golf in the US what Norman had done in Britain, benefited greatly from the Bond's support and encouragement. And he talks here about just what that meant to him.
Well, it's very, very easy for me to remember the first time that I met Norman Vinita. I was a teenager, probably in short pants, and I was hitting golf balls one weekend afternoon in Spooner Park, right opposite Beverly Park Golf Club. And this black Jaguar pulled up on the wrong side of the street, and this figure strolled towards me, and lo and behold, it was Norman Vinita. And to this day, I don't know whether he was just out for a Sunday afternoon drive and came across this young kid hitting golf balls, or whether Bill McWilliam, the pro, who was teaching me at that stage, had called Norman and asked him to come and watch me hit some balls. Anyhow, out of that encounter came quite a relationship. Norman more or less took me under his wing. He was like a godfather to me. We spent many hours in at Moore Park hitting balls, trying to refine my golf swing. We also spent countless hours out at New South Wales Golf Club. And some days we'd go out there and just spend hours in one bunker, hitting all different types of bunker shots. And Norman, through that time, more or less showed me all the experience that he had with different types of golf shots and how to play in the wind. And to this day, I still believe that Norman Vinita is the best maneuverer of a golf ball that I have ever been around. Particularly when I consider the fact that I was with him during the time that the small ball was in use. And it's a lot harder to maneuver the British-sized golf ball as it was then compared to the US-sized golf ball, which is in worldwide use now at 1.68 inches in diameter. But we'd go out and pick a hole. One comes to mind is the fifth hole at New South Wales, and I can still picture as a youngster being up there on top of the hill and hitting forwards down towards the green, and Norman would say, the ball's in this position, and you're standing this way, therefore it's going to come off the club face this way, and it's going to do this through the air, and it's going to do that when it hits the ground. And he'd show me and then have me hit some shots, and then we'd go to another location where to do something else. And you know, what great input that was for a youngster. And then when I turned pro, Norman promised me an overseas trip, and he took it upon himself to raise a bunch of money from not only his friends in the business world throughout Australia, but solicit help from the PGA of Australia, and enough money was raised to not pay all the expenses, but certainly enough to give Frank Phillips and me a wonderful trip overseas in 1956. We left with Norman, and we played an exhibition match in Singapore. We went on to Cairo and played in the Egyptian Open, where Norman got very sick with jippy tummy. In fact, when we put him on the plane real early one morning, you know, around 1:30 or 2 o'clock to fly to London, I doubted whether I'd ever see him again. He was a very sick man. Frank and I went on to Alexandria and played in the Egyptian Match Play Championship, and then we eventually met Norman in London, and we played various British tournaments and also the French Open and the Belgian Open. And one of the stories I think about the first trip was to Paris. We'd played in the French Open in Deauville, and Frank and I didn't know whether we were going to travel again, and we wanted to see all we could. So we talked Norman into taking us to Paris on the Sunday night, And we caught the train and rode up there and checked into a hotel. The next morning, Frank and I wandered off to go see the Eiffel Tower, and we were away longer than we thought we would because it was a lot longer walk than we thought it was. And when we got back to the front of the hotel, Norman was steaming. I mean, he was fuming. And he had all the luggage downstairs, and he was abusing us right and left. We didn't know that he had an appointment in London that afternoon. He didn't tell us that. But anyhow, we got in the taxi, and Norman was shouting at the taxi driver, who couldn't speak any English, and showing me the tickets and telling me airport, airport. And this poor devil got so confused that he ended up taking us to the wrong airport. Norman didn't know that there were two airports in Paris. And on the way to the second one, Norman got out in the middle of an intersection. The taxi stopped on the side of the street. Norman got out in the middle of the intersection, and he was shouting at this gendarme, trying to tell him to explain to the taxi driver that we needed to get to the other airport. And, you know, that's just one of the funny things that happened. We had many lighthearted moments, but all in all, I found Norman to be a very generous, sincere person. I have great respect for both him and his lovely wife, Elva. They were like family to me. In fact, I'd go beyond respect and say that I love them both dearly, and I wish them the best, and this is a great opportunity to express a few feelings I have about the man and his wife that took me to the second stage of my career following what Bill McWilliam and his wife Marge had done for me.
Johnny Famisham, the Australian featherweight boxing champion of the 60s, was another who Norman supported through difficult times. After being struck down by a car in 1991, Famisham was left severely handicapped, and Norman became a great contributor to the Johnny Famisham Trust.
One of the great pleasures I have had from the misfortune of my accident in 1991 has been to recognise the tremendous goodwill I have had from just so many people, some of them known to me, some not. Norman von Neider was a man who I was very much aware of, as were all who loved their sport, but not a man that I knew well. When I became well enough to learn of those who gave to my trust, which has played such a big part in my rehabilitation, I was humbled to learn that amongst those who had given of their time and money was Norman von Neider. I believe there is a brotherhood and a common bonding among sportsmen, especially those who have experienced success. Norman is an Australian icon, and to think that he was prepared to give of his time and money, making speeches and making some of his memorabilia for sale by auction to assist my cause, makes me feel just so good. I have heard from others that this is the type of man that Norman is. He has never sought recognition for what he has done for me, but clearly he has an affinity with his fellow sportsmen, and especially those who are going through hard times. My heart and sincere gratitude goes out to Norman.
Well, these were just some of the golfers, and indeed sportsmen generally, in whose careers Norman played such a great part. But the wider community also benefited from a man who has placed little importance on the material things in life. In 1995, a tribute to Norman von Neider was organised by the PGA and via the efforts of Brisbane local John Hay. Norman himself said that he would be pleased to be involved, but only on the condition that all proceeds from the night, which would include the sale of much of his memorabilia, would go to the Farmhands Drought Appeal. John Hay discusses how that came about.
Well, I received a phone call from John Downs, the proposed professional at Mudgee Golf Club, and he said Norman had expressed a wish to help regional Australia and the farmers in 1995 with the terrible drought in 94 and 95. And, you know, he was very, very concerned about it, and he'd like to auction his memorabilia. to raise money to be given to the National Farmhand Appeal. John Downs contacted me and asked me, could I organise something like that? So John Downs contacted Charlie Earp and Barney Porter and discussed the issues. Charlie Earp expressed the view that he wanted it done in the name of the Queensland PGA, and I was very happy about that, and so was Norman. And I said, suggested we make it a tribute to Norman Lanida, to, in fact, not only help the Farmhand Appeal, but give it a specific and important purpose for this state to finally recognise Norman's contribution to golf in Australia and internationally. So all was set to go. Anyhow, 10 days before it's all to happen at Royal Queensland, the Von suffered a turn, and his wife Elva rang me and said that he'd been admitted to St Andrews Hospital in Brisbane. He had to have a quintuple bypass. So I kept in touch with Dr Gardner, the heart surgeon, and had plan A, B and C organised. The Von kept telling me that he was going to be there hooker by crook. And sure enough, the miracle man, the doctor told me he hadn't drunk and he hadn't smoked all his life, and he had the constitution of a 40-year-old. And on the night, we had a special chair set up near the microphone, and we had a limousine pick him up and all that sort of thing, and his idea was to get him there, let him just sit down for a few minutes, get up and speak, and then leave, because it was a major operation. He stood on his own feet and spoke for 30 minutes. As they left, prematurely, of course, because of his condition, the auction was to follow. There was his three Australian Open miniatures. There were a number of his PGA miniature cups. There was a beautiful print of Muirfield Village in the United States, the Jack Nicklaus course, that was signed by Nicklaus and given personally to the Von. And that went for a few thousand dollars. The miniatures of the three Australian Open winners went for about $3,500 each. And many other things. The British Masters replica. It was just an outstanding event, and showed to be a man of outstanding principle and incredible ability. And we had letters from Nicklaus and all that, and we read them out.
These are but a few examples of Norman Von Nida's giving ways. This has, therefore, been the story of not only a great Australian golfer, but a great Australian man. The Von has never been one to seek recognition, but is certainly one who deserves such for his generosity with his time, resources, and compassion for his fellow man. It is perhaps fitting that we let Norman have the final say.
People have asked me why I've sort of done the things that I've done relative to helping other people become the players that were taking my place in the game. Well, through golf, I've probably had the best life of anybody in the world, and from being a caddy with no expectations of being anything other than sort of a labour during my career or during my lifetime afterwards, I consider that it's been a privilege for me to help all of the people that I've been fortunate enough to be able to assist with regard to their game, and also for other people who have not been quite so fortunate as I have during my career as a player and also as a person. And the fact that I've been able to do the things that I've done and to have the life that I've had, and sort of been able to contribute to the lives of some of the other people in golf and people outside of the game. And I'm 88 now, and I doubt that anybody in the world has had a better life than me, so that I consider myself a very lucky person.